Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 343 for November 13th, 2011, as we begin year number 7 of Whiskey Cask. Support for Whiskey Cask comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at redbreastwhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. Coming up in a few minutes.
There are many fantastic distillers, but in the view of the judges, the four that came out the real big hitters this year were Buffalo Trace, Four Roses, Tuttletown Distillery, I think I said that right, and Wild Turkey Distillery.
That's Damian Riley Smith, the publisher of Whiskey Magazine, during the presentation of this year's U.S. Icons of Whiskey Awards. I was in Louisville on Thursday for the presentation, and I'll have much more on the winners in a few minutes. I'll also have the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First off, let's look at the week's news. As always, it's brought to you by Glenmorangie. We'll start off with the sale of Tullibardine Distillery in Scotland. The French family-owned firm Maison Michel Picard purchased the Perthshire distillery for an undisclosed amount from the investor group that reopened Tullibardine in 2003. The two companies have been doing business for several years. Picard has been buying new make spirit from Tullibardine for use in its Highland Queen blended scotch. Managing Director Gabriel Picard told the Herald that the distillery's current managers and staff will keep their jobs, and that he expects to use his company's global wine distribution network to expand Tullibardine sales. Tullibardine Managing Director Douglas Ross told the Herald his ownership group had reached its maximum potential for growing the brand without adding on new investors, and that it was time to pass the distillery on to owners who could achieve that potential. We've all heard of the Angels' share, but some distilleries have more than their share of angels hanging around, and some of those spirits can be downright scary at times. Buffalo Trace has a few of those more mischievous spirits, and the Sci-Fi Network's Ghost Hunters show will feature a full investigation of the distillery's paranormal past this coming week. The show airs in the U.S. on Wednesday night, and Buffalo Trace's Amy Preske says it's the first time the show has visited a distillery.
So many viewers had written in asking them to come to Buffalo Trace because they had heard so many stories, so they came to us, and they filmed about a week or two, and because Colonel Blanton is rumored to be haunting the place. So they came to us and did some investigations, and they said it was one of the few places I've ever been to that everyone on staff felt or saw or heard something. So evidently there's a lot of spirits there.
In addition to the stuff in the barrels, so we know these are the ones that are actually taking the angel share out now, right?
Yes, now we finally figured out what is going on with all the angel share. Yep, that's where it's going. Because evidently the warehouses are a hotbed of activity for the ghost.
I have to ask, have you ever seen anything unusual?
I have not seen anything, but I've heard some things. I work late at night, so I've heard some things that are I don't really have an explanation for.
Such as?
Oh, chairs rolling around on the floor, upstairs on the third floor when no one was there. Someone said my name one time, "Hey, Amy," in the basement when I was by myself. So I heard I was there on a Saturday night by myself, and it was raining, and I heard like squeaky shoes, like somebody like walking in. So I've had three different unexplained things happen to me when I've been there.
And it scared the crap out of you all three times?
Not really. When I heard the chairs rolling around, I was kind of like, I think I'll just pack my stuff up and leave. I can do this stuff at home. The other stuff, like I didn't really think about it until, you know, afterwards, you know, and actually a coworker was like, oh, I have goosebumps, so that maybe that was the ghost, you know. So, yeah, it doesn't really freak me out too bad. They're friendly.
What will we see on this show next Wednesday night when it airs in the U.S.?
We will see them. They're investigating some areas that we've had some activity in above our gift shop. They're going to go in the warehouse. They're going to go in Stony Point, which is where Colonel Blanton died. And they're going to go in Main Bottling. Lots of different areas around the distillery they're going to head. And lots of activity they found. So, exciting.
Not to pass up a great marketing opportunity, Buffalo Trace will start offering nighttime ghost tours of the distillery starting this Thursday. The tours are free on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights. Reservations are required. More new whiskeys to talk about this week. Heaven Hill has unveiled its annual Evan Williams Single Barrel Bourbon. Heaven Hill's Larry Cass says it'll start appearing at retailers early in 2012.
It's our 17th vintage, and we just unveiled it for the first time on Saturday night at our Bardstown Whiskey Society Taste of Heaven Hill event in Bardstown. And it is going, Mark, you're going to get your bottle probably waiting for you at home now. It seems to be a little darker, a little richer perhaps in the past year or two. I know the samples that we sent out came from the fifth floor of Rickhouse G, I believe. So, great whiskey, and we're looking forward to another great vintage this year.
How does it differ from previous vintages? Any difference, really?
Well, again, I think, the barrels that I've seen that they pulled so far this year have been, perhaps just a little bit darker, a little bit more full-bodied. I thought, actually, last year's was, for our vintages, a little bit on the lighter side. So I think this one maybe is a return to a little bit more of a full-body type of whiskey.
And, in fact, Larry was right. My sample was waiting for me when I got back from Louisville. I'll have tasting notes for it later in this episode. The Glenrothes is releasing a new vintage just in time for the holidays, along with a couple of other special bottlings. It's been a while since I last talked with Ronnie Cox, but we caught up the other night in New York to discuss the Glenrothes 1995.
It happens that we've got the 1994 now just for another couple of months, probably in the United States, and we like to replace vintages with other vintages of similar sort of character. The 95 actually was the very first vintage that we ever laid down, because we started this concept in 1994, as you probably know. So the first vintage we laid down to a recipe was 1995, and it wasn't quite ready 3 years ago when we launched the second one, which is the 1998. Now, this is getting kind of confusing, but just let me tell you that the 1995 is very much a conversational style of Glenrothes. So it's, although it's replacing the 1994, which was a lighter, uplifting style of Glenrothes, 1995 is more of a conversational style. It's absolutely delicious.
And where will this be available?
The 1995, because it was the first ever laid down vintage, will be available now to everybody around the world. And we've had it launched already in Spain and the UK. We're starting with it now in Japan as well. And now, gratefully, we accept the United States as another one of those good markets for it.
What other vintages are you working on besides the new expression that we'll talk about in a minute?
Oh, Mark, these are the sort of questions that I should never answer. But I can tell you quite categorically that what we do is to replace vintages of similar sort of character. You know what I like to do with Glenrothes, and it's different from anybody else, is to have vintages which are uppers, vintages which are conversational, vintages which are relaxers. And so when one of those vintages runs out, we will replace it with another one with a different personality, but obviously the same character, because it comes from the same distillery.
Now let's talk about the editor's cask, because this is another unusual one that you worked on with the help of some of my colleagues in the whiskey writing business. How did this come about?
Well, it was just an idea, really. We had found about 18 very unusual casks, and Glenrothes, I don't really like bottling up single casks unless they're very peculiar and good, of course. I mean, I never call single casks the best casks in the world, because they are a one-dimensional view, snapshot, if you like, on the Glenrothes life. And I always think that two casks are better than one, because they give a greater complexity. In the same way that solving a very complex puzzle with one person is not all that easy, but with two people it tends to be a little bit easier. So this came about. We got all these casks that we thought were exceptional in various peculiar ways. And what we did was we took four editors from around the world, brought them over to Scotland. We spent 3 days up in Scotland, going through initially 18 casks, then whittling it down. And on the third day, we discovered that actually two of the editors agreed on one cask and two of the editors agreed on another cask. So it was my fault, really, for not having an uneven number of editors to be able to get some sort of consensus. But it was very interesting. So we agreed to disagree. And we, instead of having one cask, then we selected two casks. And of course, these were all done with blind tastings. So it wasn't... And the interesting thing, really interesting thing, was that two editors came up with the 1996 cask and two editors with the 1979 cask. So this is really, along with our sort of saying right from the very beginning when we launched the brand in 1994, that it's all about maturity, not about age. And people's preferences, individual preferences, are very different. So Taiwan and the United States came together, and Germany and France came together. It was quite interesting, but two very different expressions of Glenrothes, and both equally delicious. But I mean, what do you choose, a Rembrandt or a Picasso? It's you know.
So the one cask will go to Taiwan and the U.S., the other will go to Germany and France, essentially. How will this work?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do. So we split the one that was chosen by Taiwan and America between the two. So we split it down the middle. You've got a 750 coming into the States, and you've got a 700 going to Taiwan. And then the German, the 1979, we'll be shipping some to Germany and then some throughout the world as well, because that one's been signed by all four editors.
Now, what are the plans to try to do this again in the future? Will you try this again, or was this a one-off?
No, I think it was a great success. I think we definitely will. Really, the issue will be finding the great casks to do it with. Because, as I say, we're not taking just the very, very best casks, but what we're doing is taking ones that are sufficiently peculiar to allow the editors a great breadth of choice, and to whittle it down then to their favorite ones. So we've still got quite a lot of really good casks coming up, and you know, we do a lot of experimentation at Glenrothes with different cask ends, different woods and so on, different finishes of the sherry casks before we actually fill it with whiskey. So it'll come. I'm not quite sure when we're going to do the next one, possibly next year, possibly the year after, I'm not sure.
Now let's turn to the Whiskey Makers competition, because you've decided to bring that back for 2012. But the payoff is going to be many years in the future this time around, right?
Yes, indeed, because obviously what they're doing is, the great objective is for them to fill the 2012 vintage, or part of it. And so we're looking for four from America, from the United States of America, and we're asking people to go online as of the 11th of November to fill in their vintage moment, and then that will be judged. And at the beginning of 2012, then we will select the lucky winners, so that in May I will accompany four guys to Scotland, and they will spend 4 or 5 days with me enjoying whiskey making, working with the boys in the distillery, and also everything, the periphery events that we have to go with that. So that's entertaining in the Scottish fashion there, with a local lad going fishing, just having a good time up there, and staying at Rothy's house, which is our spiritual home in Speyside.
And it's not just the U.S., you're doing this with other countries as well, right?
Well, we are, yes. Last year we were drawing four people from different parts of the world. We actually got two from the U.K., one from Taiwan and one from the States. This year was actually country-specific, so we're looking for four from the United States of America, and then we're doing separate competitions for others, but it won't be during the same week. I will dedicate my entire week then to those four that come from, the lucky winners that come from the United States of America, and look forward to it.
But let's get those other countries in, because since we have listeners all over the world, there are going to be others who will want to take part in this.
Yeah, well, then we've got, I've got three other competitions running for international people, so coming from all over the world. It doesn't matter where you come from, there's an entry for all those people. So all you have to do is go on the website, theglenrothes.com, and you will find the entry form.
Back to the editor's cask for a second. Noah Rothbaum of Liquor.com represented the U.S. in the selection of those two casks.
Well, it was definitely a hard decision. It was one of those things when it sounds like an easy thing to pick a whiskey to bottle, but when you're presented with 18 different samples, all of them wonderful in their own unique way, you know, you realize what a hard task that, you know, these master blenders, master distillers, malt masters, you know, face every year. And after, you know, several hours of sampling and tasting and scoring, it really came down to basically two casks. The one that I liked, I saw myself drinking. It was enjoyable to drink. I was trying to pick something as wonderful as some of the previous Glenrothes vintages. I didn't want people to taste this one and for to fall short of all the other amazing whiskeys that they put out in the last few years. So this one I thought was, you know, very, you know, complex and had, you know, beautiful notes and, you know, would be a real treat for whiskey drinkers.
What are your notes on this one?
Wow. Well, I, you know, it'd be interesting to taste it again. I haven't tasted it since May, but, you know, there was fruit, there was spice. It's very smooth. You know, it really opens up over time. The other bottling that will go to Europe is definitely a little bit more sherried, a little bit bolder. This one's a little bit more subtle, and I could really see myself drinking it over the course of a night as it opens up and changes and becomes something even more wonderful.
There's also a new 1988 vintage coming from the Glenrothes in early 2012. It'll replace the 1985 vintage, which is beginning to run out of stock. I'll have tasting notes for the 1988 vintage and the editor's cask bottling for the U.S. and Taiwan later on. Now, you're probably aware that I love photography, so that makes the latest release from the Macallan even more interesting to me than usual. The Macallan's 12-year-old Sherry Oak expression is getting a limited edition package featuring photos by artist Nick Veazey. He specializes in X-ray photography and turned his camera on the six elements that Macallan refers to as its six pillars. Each box will have one of Nick's images of either a feather, scissors, liquid drop, still, cask, or house on it. There's also a more exclusive Macallan coming for the holidays. The latest Lalique decanter expression features a 60-year-old Macallan inside. It'll sell for $20,000 a decanter, with just 400 decanters available worldwide. Jura is releasing a new 1976 vintage. Faitha Cuaran, and I'm sure I'm butchering that, means Land of the Rowan in Gaelic, and the bottling features a rowan tree. Just 500 bottles will be available worldwide. It was matured in three different casks, bottled at 46% ABV. Scottish Field Magazine has announced the winners of its annual Whiskey Challenge. Adelphi's Dalluane 27-year-old bottling was named Whiskey of the Year and also won the gold medal for independent bottlings. Old Pulteney 12-year-old won the gold for bottlings priced under £35 each. The Lagavulin Distillery Edition took top honors for single malts priced between £35 and £80. And Glenglassaugh's Manager's Legacy won gold for bottles priced over £80. Wieden Mackay's Luxury 19-year-old was the gold medalist among blended scotches. Grand Traverse Distillery in Michigan is getting ready to release its first official bourbon. The single-barrel 100% straight bourbon release will go on sale December 10th at the distillery in Traverse City, Michigan. Sales are limited to 3 bottles per customer until they run out. On the political front, Scotch Whiskey Association officials will be in India this week, trying to persuade government leaders to lower the tariff on imported spirits once again. The tariff was dropped from 750% to 150% back in 2001, and SWA leaders believe India could become one of their largest export markets if tariffs were dropped to those resembling other markets. For example, Brazil imposes a 20% tariff on Scotch whiskey imports. China's tariff is just 10%. In other news, Glenfiddich is making available 11 special bottles of what's likely its oldest ever single malt bottled for charity. The bottles of 55-year-old Glenfiddich are being auctioned around the world to honor 110-year-old Janet Sheed Roberts. She's the granddaughter of William Grant, who founded Glenfiddich and William Grant & Sons. Proceeds from the first sale at Bonhams in Edinburgh on December 14th will benefit WaterAid, which works to provide clean drinking water around the world. Meanwhile, the latest Bonhams auction was this past week in Edinburgh. The highlight was a bottle of 48-year-old Glenlivet distilled all the way back in 1883. It sold for £18,750, or about $30,144. A 50-year-old Macallan distilled in 1928 sold for £16,875. That translates to $27,130. Bonhams will hold its next whiskey auction on December 8th in New York City. Finally, Springbank's Whiskey School is almost sold out for all 10 weeks of classes in 2012. There are a few spots left, though, for the weeks of April 16th, April 30th, and June 18th. The cost is £975, or about $1,570 for the week. It includes lodging and meals, but not the cost of getting to Campbelltown. I've posted a link for more details at the WhiskeyCast website. And that's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Let's check out the comments of the week now, brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. As I mentioned earlier, this episode marks the start of our seventh year, and I've received a lot of congratulatory notes in the last few days. Marsh Middleton in South Africa was one of the first listeners to get in touch with me during those early days, back in late 2005. He posted this on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. A massive congratulations, Mark. 6 years and the first episode feels like yesterday. Here's to quality and consistency over the years. Many more. Well done and congratulations again. Thank you, Marsh. Meanwhile, Michael Murphy posted this. Congratulations, Mark. I'll toast another 6 years of WhiskeyCast with a 6-year-old two of clubs from Hanyu. Thank you, Michael. On that note, Matt Wooler in Australia had this comment on the interview with Ichiro Akuto in the last episode. Hi, Mark. Just listened to episode 342 and the interview with Ichiro Akuto. It was good to hear some history firsthand as I had read about the man and the distillery a few years ago. Last year, I managed to score a dram each of the Ichiro's Malt Double Distilleries and Ichiro's Malt Mizunara Wood Reserve bottlings, and have to say they were very different indeed. Well worth the experience, reminded me of Japanese cedar wood and pine forests. Anybody that might want to get even more detail, Nunjata had a great piece a few years back with a few photos of the distillery just after opening. Amazing how small the pot stills are, too. And Matt posted a link to Chris Bunting's Nunjata blog story at the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. Finally, Evgeny Vershinin had this comment from Moscow. Hi, Mark. We'll open Long Row 8 years to celebrate your 6th birthday. Long live WhiskeyCast. By the way, your bright rays of whiskey knowledge sometimes are the only source of accurate and up-to-date information of particular whiskey events in Moscow. It's a madness that in such a big city as Moscow that there is only one decent global whiskey event, Whiskey Live, and on its website the only info is private, face control by invitations. That means to any whiskey fan like me, bleep off and die, you're not welcomed. Can you shed any light on this event, or Moscow and its Whiskey Live sadly will stay North Korea of the whiskey world for those who have a lot of money only? Well, I checked into this. Apparently, the Russian government has been cracking down on the liquor industry lately, including forcing all of the whiskey companies now selling in Russia to reapply for their licenses. Just about the only way they can even hold an event like Whiskey Live in Russia is for the organizers to make it invitation only. I have contacted them to see if there's any way for listeners to get an invitation to attend. Whiskey Live Moscow is set for November 25th and 26th, and I'll keep you posted. Now, if you have a question, suggestion, or a comment, I'd love to hear from you. You can always post something on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, or just email me. The address is comments@whiskeycast.com. The comments of the week are brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker, on the web at johnnywalker.com. Click on the banner at the WhiskeyCast website and become a Whiskey Insider today. Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you, as always, by Laphroaig. Glasgow's Whiskey Festival is coming up on Saturday, along with the International Whiskey Festival at The Hague in the Netherlands this coming weekend. Interwhiskey is set for the weekend of November 25th through the 27th in Frankfurt. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's UK chapter will hold St. Andrew's Day tastings on November 30th at the Vaults in Leith and in London. The U.S. chapter's final single malt extravaganza of the fall will be on December 1st in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Bourbon's Bistro in Louisville will host a Woodford Reserve Repeal Day dinner on December 4th, and Nichols and Perks in Stourbridge, England will host a Gordon and MacPhail tasting on December 9th. Those are just a few of the many whiskey events worldwide over the next few weeks. You'll find a complete list at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Visit the Laphroaig website at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
WhiskeyCast. brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Michael Power, stock controller, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
I've been working in Middleton Distillery for the last 28 years. My job base is to organise deliveries of the cereals that are used to make Redbreast. Also, I have to be very mindful of the quality of the cereals coming in, such as the barley and the malt, which are specifically used for Redbreast. We're very mindful of the continuity of supply and the continuity of quality, and we use grain suppliers from the Munster area, which is one of the best growing areas for barley in Ireland. I have been dealing with basically the same people, such as Henry Goods and Pat Den, who have been supplying us with barley. It's usually spring barley going back all those years. Over the years, I've grown to like Redbreast more and more. It's because it's like the distillery itself. Something has developed with me. When you've tasted other whiskies, you learn to drink whiskey, and then later on, when you want more complexity or you want something more from a whiskey, tend to go to whiskies like Redbreast. Redbreast is unique because of the way it's made in the traditional way. The pot stills would have been the traditional way to make Irish whiskey.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
Time now for Whiskey Cast in Depth. Whiskey Magazine announced its U.S. Icons of Whiskey Award winners on Thursday at a luncheon in Louisville. Full disclosure, as the magazine's U.S. contributing editor, I was on the panel that nominated and voted on this year's winners. Those winners will go up against the Scottish icons announced several weeks ago, and those to be named from the rest of the world soon, for the overall Icons of Whiskey honors to be announced at Whiskey Live London next March. The legendary Elmer T. Lee of Buffalo Trace was named American Whiskey Ambassador of the Year. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to attend the luncheon on Thursday. Bernie Lubbers of Jim Beam was the highly commended runner-up. Jack Daniels was named Best Visitors Center of the Year, with Heaven Hill's Bourbon Heritage Center in Bardstown receiving highly commended honors. Federal Wine and Spirits in Boston was named Single Store Retailer of the Year. Kentucky's Liquor Barn, the best chain retailer, and for ScotchLovers.com was named Best Online Retailer. Buffalo Trace won Brand Innovator of the Year for the Single Oak Project, while Four Roses was highly commended for its special single-barrel bottlings. That leaves the Distillers of the Year. Let's listen as Whiskey Magazine publisher Damian Riley Smith announces the Craft Distiller of the Year honors.
There was a new category we introduced a couple of years ago, which reflects those new, smaller distilleries, which have rather cleverly come up with this phrase called craft, which I think suggests that they handcraft it, and they do it in a slightly less sophisticated way than the bigger distillers. I don't think that really is it. I think they just have they have smaller volumes by definition, and they are newer. And I'm delighted to hear from the KDA that they are welcomed into their organisation, although as long as they're meeting the standards, the high standards of bourbon in this particular part of the country. The category has evolved very, very fast, and there are many, many out there, but the shortlist this year of craft whisky distillers is pretty short, actually. There is Balcones Distilling, High West Distillery, and Hudson Valley. The highly commended goes to Hudson Valley, who sadly are not here, but the winner goes to a distillery who has extended the art of distilling by creating smoked whiskey, in which the spirit gets infused with smoke in a process instead of smoking the grains itself before mashing it. I've also heard of something I've never heard before, which is blue corn. I still don't quite understand what it means, but I will find out afterwards because I'm going to sample it. They're not in this state. They're in another part of the country, and they're all the way from Waco in Texas, and they are Balcones Distilling. Chip Tate. Come on up.
Chip Tate flew all the way from Waco to Louisville on very short notice to accept the award.
When you got the call to come to Louisville for the Icons of Whiskey Luncheon, What did you think?
Very surprised. I didn't even know. I feel like I ran the 400 and I've won the long jump. I kind of didn't know I was up for that. We're very young distillery, and I didn't always think that. I think this year is the first year that craft has been a category. So yeah, I did not expect it at all. I'm very pleased to be at the luncheon, but also surprised.
Chip, tell me about plans for, I guess, Balcones version 2.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would even say it's an extension of what we've already got going, in part because it's only about three blocks away. You know, the current distillery, I was just saying, is beautiful in its way, but with a very sort of homegrown feel to it. I mean, we've built just about everything in there, including done a lot of the framing, and I mean, it's rustic. The new building is as well, but it's a 1923 fireproof storage building that we're converting into a distillery. So the current distillery is about 2,000 square feet, and the new facility is about 63,000 square feet. So it gives us a little bit more room, and a couple acres besides. So yeah, we were thrilled to find something so close, so we literally just run our forklifts up and down the back roads there right now. It's really just kind of an extension of what we've got. But we're going to be putting in a new equipment kit, hopefully in by mid to late summer. And I think it'll be quite something to see.
You're going to build a whole new set of stills, or you're just going to move your existing stills over?
It's going to be a new set of stills. You know, we're very fortunate to have the problems we do, which are that we're selling everything we can make, but we need to make more, which on our current equipment, barring going to a 24-hour schedule or something else unwise, it's really the only option. So we're actually quite excited about it. The biggest difference will be that, you know, the stills will be a little bit bigger, but what's the biggest pinch in our current place is that if it's liquid and it needs to be heated, it happens in the stills right now. So mashing happens in the stills. Heating up hot water happens in the stills, wash, distilling, spirit. So we're actually only able to run spirit about six times a month. And, you know, with more space and more equipment, the biggest difference will just be being able to distill spirit every day.
And you'll have space now for warehousing too, right?
That's right. You know, who knows? I'm past knowing when we're done, but it is a huge boon to have the new space. And it's also nice because essentially there are five spaces about 12,000 square feet, and one of them is an appended single-story building with a steel truss wood roof, which will be expanded in places to accommodate the stills. The one next door is four stories on top of each other, so obviously the temperatures will be different between those different spaces, and that's always a nice set of options for a distiller to have.
In September, I saw your whiskey, as we reported in the episode from Glasgow, on sale in Scotland at the Good Spirits Company in Glasgow. Are you surprised by the reception your whiskeys have received?
Yes. I mean, no and yes. In terms of, obviously, when you do this, you hope for something like that. But it's kind of like, you know, training for some big sports event or something. Mentally, you're picturing that happening. So in some sense, you're working for it. But when it actually happens, it's kind of like, wow, I somehow didn't expect it, even though I was aiming for it. So we've been really, really pleased and a little surprised how well received and how quickly received some of our stuff has been, because it is different. I think it appeals to a traditional sensibility, but they aren't traditional styles. So right there, you wonder how long is it. You know, we're a very conservative lot, whiskey drinkers. But it's been exciting to see not only an open set of minds in the whiskey community, but just all of the things going on with the connection to the food movement. There's a lot of interesting things that are, I think, helping people at least try what we make.
By the way, Chip says his new warehouse will have enough extra space to house whiskeys for any other craft distillers who may be short on space. That leaves the Distiller of the Year honors. Once again, here's Damien.
The Distiller of the Year, which is sponsored by Glencairn Crystal, who kindly provide the lovely glasses we use, has many has quite a long shortlist for obvious reasons. There are many fantastic distillers, but in the view of the judges, the four that came out, the real big hitters this year were Buffalo Trace, Four Roses, Tuttletown Distillery, I think I said that right, and Wild Turkey Distillery. Real tough one to stand here and say anyone won and anyone didn't win. But, as I said, I'm the messenger purely. And the judges felt that two came to the top and one rose above all others. The one that just was pipped at the post is Wild Turkey. So, Jimmy Russell, if I could welcome you. And the final category, the final award is for the Distiller of the Year. So it can't be Wild Turkey, it's going to be Buffalo Trace, Four Roses, or Tuttletown. The winner, for quietly releasing some spectacular whiskies during the year, these allowed the master distiller the chance to highlight how different yeast strains can make a difference in flavour and style. One of them was called the Marriage Collection, and one was the Single Barrel Bottlings. So for those who know their Four Roses, they know it's Four Roses.
Four Roses Master Distiller Jim Rutledge and I talked after the ceremony. First of all, your reaction to winning Distiller of the Year honors.
Absolutely fantastic. It's second year in a row. Last year was unbelievable, and this year is just, like I said, absolutely fantastic.
What was going through your mind when you saw your name come up again?
When I saw the highly commended, I wasn't surprised because of what we do, but to win it all again for the second time, that it's beyond words, really, to describe my feelings. We were gone from the U.S. and for so long, and to have this happen, and all in the past just few years that we've been back in the U.S., it's living a dream come true.
And let's talk about that, because the previous owners of Four Roses, Seagram's, took Four Roses out of the market for many years here, and you only really came back in under new ownership in the last 10 years, right?
That's right. I had an ongoing debate with Seagram to let their blended whiskey with our name on the bottle go away and let us bring a bourbon back home. And our bourbon had disappeared from the U.S. by 1960. That had been going on for years. It wasn't going to happen. I wasn't going to stop trying, and they weren't going to stop saying no, I guess. But unfortunately, it took Seagram exiting the beverage alcohol world at the end of 2001 to make it happen. We began to make plans immediately, and that was the beginning of 2002. And we really got started. We introduced our single barrel in September 2004. It took us 2 years for our single barrel to become the number one selling single barrel bourbon in Kentucky. That was the same year. In 2006, we introduced our small batch. And during this time, we're growing our barrel inventories to roll out in the U.S. And right now, it was a little over 4 years ago that we had sufficient barrel inventories to move into the first state outside Kentucky. And we had chosen Kentucky when our new owners said, sure, let's bring it back to the U.S. We chose Kentucky a little because it's our home, but primarily it's the most competitive bourbon market in the world. We wanted to see how we stood up against the now well-established brands. And we get building our barrel inventories, and a little over 4 years ago, about 4.5 years ago, we had sufficient inventories to move into the first market outside Kentucky, which was the metropolitan area of New York. And later that year, we went into Illinois and Tennessee. And right now, we're in 45 states.
And getting closer to 50, right?
We're getting closer, right.
What makes this whiskey so unique, besides the 10 different recipes that we've talked about, the different strains of yeast that you're using to create these different whiskeys? What makes Four Roses so? What makes Four Roses so unique?
Well, I think the main thing is the 10 recipes, very unique flavors that we distill and age separately. using two grain recipes, two mash bills, both very high in rye content, which generates a bit of a spiciness that's more so than any of the other bourbon brands. And instead of one proprietary yeast, we have five. So the combination of the two and the five yeast cultures is the way we generate the 10. But I think the smoothness, the mellowness, the nice, long, soft finish of Four Roses Bourbon is very unique. And there's a price to pay to achieve that. And to achieve something really exceptional as an end product, you have to start with the best raw materials. We're now in our 52nd year of using the same farmers or families of farmers in a small geographic area of Indiana to acquire corn. And they know what we need. We get the best of the crops, not all the crops, and we pay a premium to get those crops. We also look at every rye crop grown around the world. We use so much rye in our recipes. This year we're using rye grain from Germany, and we have for the last several years. We've used rye from Sweden, Canada. We look at all the rye crops, and we choose the best. So to get achieve the smoothness, mellowness as an end product, it's critical to start off with the best raw materials, and that's the price to pay that I was speaking of.
Now, you're already working on your 2012 special releases, right? The single barrel and all?
We've already selected the recipe we will use for our 2012 limited edition single barrel bourbon, and we're getting very close to, and the limited edition single barrel will be introduced probably in April. The limited edition small batch bourbon, which will be introduced next September, we're getting very, very close to making a final selection. In fact, we'll be looking at them again next week, some of the final contenders. And when you have 10 recipes, and we'll use three or four of the recipes next year for a limited edition small batch, but even three or four, the numbers are unbelievable. You use all 10, there's an infinite number of ways you can take 10 recipes and blend them in different ratios. And so it's a challenge. The limited edition small batch bourbons are a lot of fun because it takes so long and just get the right combination. You could have two recipes, a 50-50, 80-20, or 75-25, and the flavor changes dramatically just with two. So when you begin to add more of that and the combinations of different percentages, it takes a long time. And we've been working on it for several months. And hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have the recipe we'll use for next year.
Are you surprised by the reception your whiskeys have gotten in the marketplace since coming back to the U.S.?
You're asking the wrong person. No, I'm not surprised. The challenge was to get beyond the image of the blended whiskey with our name on it. But I've always, and this is the arguments and all the debates with the Seagram marketing people, I was so confident in the bourbon we were making. It was very, very frustrating. It's hard to even put in words to have a bourbon of this quality, but yet unavailable in the U.S. And to have this opportunity, that's the silver lining behind, I think, the dark cloud for the industry is when Seagram exited this business. But the silver lining behind that cloud is we're having this conversation right now, and we're back in the U.S.
Once again, the U.S. winners will compete against those from Scotland and the rest of the world for the overall Icons of Whiskey honors next March in London. Time now for the What I'm Tasting This Week department. I'd like to welcome another new sponsor on board. Last year, Villeroy & Bock's Fine Flavor line of whiskey glassware was part of our holiday gift guide. They were so pleased with the response that they came back to help sponsor this segment through the holidays. Now, we heard about the Glenrothes Editor's Cask bottling that will be available in the U.S. and Taiwan. It's from 1996 and is bottled at 58% ABV. The nose is rich and smooth with a great balance of dried fruit and spices, including orange peel, pumpkin pie, nutmeg, cinnamon, and allspice notes. The taste is dry and intense with strong cinnamon, black licorice, brown sugar, and caramel notes. The finish is dry, spicy, and long with a good balance of cinnamon and caramel syrup. I'm scoring the Glenrothes Editor's Cask a 93. I have asked for a sample of the European version to compare this one to. Meanwhile, the Glenrothes 1998 vintage is bottled at a more conventional 43% ABV. The nose has notes of sandalwood, dried orange peel, cocoa powder, and a subtle touch of almonds. The taste has notes of dark chocolate, vanilla, old leather, and hints of toffee and almonds. The finish is long with notes of dried orange peel, hazelnut, and a touch of wood smoke. I'm scoring the Glenrothes 1988 vintage a 92. Now, we also heard about the Evan Williams 2002 single-barrel bourbon that will be out after the holidays. It's bottled at 43.3% ABV. My sample from barrel number one has classic bourbon notes on the nose, with toasted oak, a hint of smoke, vanilla, cocoa, and touches of pipe tobacco and leather. The taste is rich and spicy with caramel, cocoa, vanilla, and touches of maple syrup and cinnamon. The finish is medium length with caramel syrup and brown sugar notes. I'm scoring the 2002 Evan Williams Single Barrel Bourbon an 89. This week's tasting notes are brought to you by Villeroy & Bock. Look for the fine flavor line of whiskey glassware at fine retailers and Villeroy-Bock.com. They're glasses worthy of your whiskey. I'll be adding these notes to the free WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The Apple version is brought to you by the Glenrothes, the Android version by Ben Romick. Of course, they're also available at the WhiskeyCast website, along with the calendar of events, my whiskey photos, the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. Support for WhiskeyCast comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at RedbreastWhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011. And comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.